It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right.
We're already laughing. It must be a good morning.
We're good. All right, let's start out. We got plenty to cover.
Oh, if people only heard the things that went on before the mics went live.
They'd still be asleep. All right. Let's start out with local and budget issues. How about Metro? How about that Metro?
Yeah, we're getting budget shortfalls right and left here.
You're going to throw them under the bus?
Well, you might feel thrown under the bus. Metro declared this week that they're going to come up with a $100 million shortfall for 2010. And then in 2011, because of less collection of sales tax revenue, they're going to have a $123.6 million shortfall. And that this could lead to a 20% cut in service. This is after Metro's already hiked fares by three times, by 25 cents each in the last 2 years. And it's also after the 2006 Transit Now initiative passed that was supposed to expand service, not see service cutbacks of 20%. And, of course, all of us have experienced increasingly crowded buses and problems with buses running late as a result. And while Metro says that they're going to be getting some of the stimulus money from the stimulus package, they're not sure how much of it can be or will be they'll be able to use for operating costs. So that was very bad news. Also, the state came out and said this week that their budget shortfall is not the $3 to $5 million or the $3 to $6 million they had originally said, but it's going to be closer to $3 to $6 billion. It's going to be closer to $8 billion. And they pointed out that, well, 70% of their revenue, actually more than 70% of the state's revenue, comes from sales taxes and from business and occupation taxes. And that because people are spending less, there's less money for state services and for Metro bus services. Of course, this $8 billion shortfall puts the state of Washington up there within the top 10 states that are having problems with their budgets. And the percentage of a shortfall compared to the entire budget here in the state of Washington is about the same as what California was experiencing prior to passing their bill that had severe cutbacks in it. Governor Greg Warr had proposed a budget earlier this year before the legislature convened that had about $3 billion in cuts. And Democrats in the legislature right now, because the state legislature is in session, are talking about coming up with a initiative for the ballot for voters to decide on a tax increase. I don't see that passing with the economy the way it is right now, and with the fact that people's real estate taxes have gone up because, of course, their real estate taxes are based on assessed property values that have a year or more delay in them. In addition to all the special levies that taxpayers voted for last year, including parks levies and school levies, fire districts,
although those were specific to King County and in the case of Metro, the regions, not a statewide vote.
Other counties have passed similar levies in the past as well, and so people are seeing that on their property tax bills. But and there was the Tri-County transit initiative, right, that passed as well. That adds money to your real estate taxes too. So, I don't see a tax increase passing. But there are other solutions that the state could be working on. One of them is they could spend more of the surplus. After all, you could argue that this kind of an economic downturn, the worst since the Great Depression, is in fact an emergency, and that is what the emergency funds should be used for. Governor Gregoire has proposed using a small portion of the surplus, not the entire amount. Legislators could also look at deficit spending. It's not prohibited by the Washington State Constitution, and they could consider it. Longer term, they could talk about tax reform, and of course I'm going to put in my pitch once again for a state income tax, which probably would have will never be passed in the state of Washington, but we definitely need something.
But yeah, one of the things that's happening systematically with the state revenues streams, and this is why we're getting a shortfall, is because of a loss of revenue, is that over time, because we don't have an income tax, because we're so dependent on sales and property tax, it's much more vulnerable to economic downturns, number one. But number two, because you're so dependent on the sales tax, the retail sales is becoming a smaller and smaller portion of our economy over time. So you're structurally building in not only vulnerability to these downturns, but also over time having the state budget be less and less a percentage of the state's economy, which is a problem.
Well, and also there's the argument that if you imposed a state income tax with a repeal of a sales tax, you would make the tax structure in the state much more equitable.
Yeah, because it's very regressive right now.
Yeah, the sales tax impacts poorer people much more than it does wealthier people. And as Job pointed out, it's unreliable. In an economic downturn, people spend less and the state collects less in sales tax at a time when state services are needed more than ever. So that's my pitch once again for a state income tax.
Is anybody going to listen to us?
Oh, no. And you know, there are other ways to save money, too. I mean, there was a bill up for what I considered real sentencing reform to get rid of the three strikes law in the state of Washington. Of course, advocates of the criminal justice system came out and said, oh, you can't repeal the three strikes law, you know, crime will go up, etc., when in fact many studies have been done that show that sentencing laws have no impact really in crime rates. Crime rates are much more responsive to things, to socioeconomic factors like the state of the economy, the quality of schools, the availability of jobs that pay well, you know, the availability of contraceptives and the number of teenage pregnancies, et cetera, all are much more closely linked to crime rates than three strikes laws and sentencing issues.
Yeah, and you've also got with the war on
drugs. But it would save the state a lot of money.
And with the war on drugs, you've also got a lot of nonviolent offenders in
exactly.
the jails that are costing the state a ton of money.
If you decriminalized marijuana or you made it a civil infraction to possess small amounts of pot, then that would save the state millions of dollars in jail time for people who have basically committed a crime where no one is the victim.
All right. Moving on. It's starting to look like there's plenty of contenders for upcoming Seattle City Council seats, but so far not too many people jumping in on the mayor's race.
Well, we've got one this week, however, and you know, after all this time lamenting that we're not going to get a serious challenge to Mayor Greg Nichols, it looks like there will be one, and now hitting it's all wrong. Tim Burgess, probably the most conservative member of City Council. He's been on for only a year and a half. He is an ex-cop, and I mention that only because it's a central part of his political identity, and he has turned out as a council person to be much more conservative than how he positioned himself during his campaign for city council. He announced this week that he is forming an exploratory committee to looking at a run for mayor. This is interesting for several reasons. One of them being, of course, that he and Greg Nichols would be drawing money from pretty much the same sources in terms of their appeal to the city's business community and corporate donors. Above and beyond that, a two-way race makes it much more feasible for a third candidate to join in for somebody to run from the progressive side of Nichols as well, because there's widespread dissatisfaction with Nichols. Private polling that's been done over the past few months shows him in head-to-head races with all sorts of people like Peter Steinbrück and Nick Licata and Phil Talmadge and folks like that, where Nichols comes out behind any of those figures in a two-person race. In a three-person race where Nichols is facing somebody from his right as well as somebody from his left, I would think that would be an even more pronounced advantage. So hopefully we'll see somebody else leap in. Now, I was talking today with a member of City Council who is not Tim Burgess and not a fan of Tim Burgess, who was saying, or Greg Nichols, who was saying that this person thought that somebody from the environmental community was likely to join the race as well.
That would be that, nice. That would be really cool.
Yeah, and there, despite Nichols' you know, publicity as being an environmentalist and global warming and so on and so forth, there actually is a lot of dissatisfaction with Nichols in the environmental community for a variety of reasons. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out, but it is starting to look now like we will have a real mayor's race rather than just a re-coronation of Nichols as we had 4 years ago.
Right, not the least of which, one of the things that the environmental community dislikes about Nichols is his pushing the Mercer Corridor project. I noticed on Friday that...
And the tunnel as well.
Yeah, I noticed on Friday, especially the tunnel, but I noticed on Friday that the City Council Committee released they eliminated the limits for spending on the Mercer Corridor project, so that looks like that's going to go forward. They're expecting some $50 million, I think, from the economic stimulus plan that isn't going to plug the hole in the funding for the Mercer Corridor project, but it's going to go a long ways towards filling that. And, you know, I have to say, in a time when there's an economic downturn and the city needs money for services, do we really need another, you know, pretty project for Paul Allen?
All right. Moving on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah. Barack Obama released his housing plan this week, $75 billion in incentives to banks to get them to refinance borrowers into loans with lower payments. The interesting thing about this is that it's only going to help people who are probably already in pretty good shape. People who qualify will include mostly those folks who initially got mortgages that are like 30-year fixed rate, but they were at a higher interest rates than interest rates are now, and they just haven't paid enough equity on their homes to be able to refinance. That's not those are not the people who really need the help. Another class of people might be helped, folks who have adjustable rate mortgages, but the incentives only specify that banks negotiate to lower their payments, not to refinance them out of adjustable rate mortgages into fixed rate mortgages, which would be really helpful. No, what it's going to do is it's just going to take these people who are in adjustable rate mortgages, help them for a while with their payments, and just put off the problem for a few months or a couple of years.
So what's the rationale for doing it this way?
Well, he wants to stabilize the housing market. And I think what he's thinking is, well, we just stabilize it for a year or two and then prices will go up again and it will help, you know, and it will solve itself. That's not gonna happen. That's not gonna happen. If prices recover, it's going to take a while. It's not going to be, you know, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. It's going to take a while. And this is not going to do it. Another part of the plan that he announced was $200 billion in more funding for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And for folks who don't remember, those are the two quasi-governmental agencies that pretty much helped to make a market in mortgages and mortgage-backed securities by providing money to banks to loan out through, and the way that they do that is by buying up mortgages from banks. So basically, banks make the loans, and then Fannie and Freddie buy the loans from them, thereby providing cash to banks to loan out, et cetera. So they pretty much make the market in mortgages. And since the economic downturn, since the housing crisis, Fannie and Freddie have pretty much accounted for, they used to account for about 50% of the mortgage market. Now they account for almost 100%, somewhere around 90%. Because banks are not loaning nearly at the rates that they were. So the $200 billion for Fannie and Freddie is basically to help them buy up more mortgages from banks, and it's to help people who have their mortgages through Fannie and Freddie but are underwater, and that means that they owe more on their house than their house is actually worth. But if you're too much underwater and you're too close to foreclosure, or you've already started the foreclosure process, you probably won't be helped by this. You have to be people with good credit, people who are on the verge of being in trouble, not people who are actually in trouble, which is the problem that I have with all of these government solutions so far, whether it was proposed by Henry Paulson, by George Bush, by by Barack Obama, is that it's helping people who may get into trouble. It's not helping people who are really in trouble and really need it right now. And another thing I want to talk about this week as well is that we saw the word nationalization get batted around quite a bit in the media this week, and it's becoming not such a dirty word anymore. Economists Paul Krugman, Nouriel Roubini, pundits Michael Hirsch of Newsweek and Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, a couple of former IMF economists, Simon Johnson and Ken Rogoff, all mentioned nationalization as probably the next best option for saving the financial industry, the banking industry. And finally, even Alan Greenspan, in an interview with the Financial Times newspaper of London, said, he had a great quote, he said, "It may be necessary to temporarily nationalize some banks in order to facilitate a swift and orderly restructuring." And then even Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, quote, "We cannot keep pouring good money after bad. If nationalization is what works, then we should do it." That's a Republican senator.
From, that's one of the most conservative Republican senators.
From the Deep South, yes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting now that they're talking about nationalization. Of course, it made the stock market plummet, but if it has to be done, it has to be done. And it's interesting that everybody but Barack Obama is talking about it.
All right. We also see this week that the automakers are coming back with some new plans
about a month or so after the last handout for the big automakers, GM and Chrysler, gone back to the government asking for more billions. And it's become very, very clear in this round of requests for more financing that GM is in such terrible shape that the government should step back and let them fail. I mean, the U.S. can more than make do with two major car manufacturers rather than three, and GM has mismanaged their business so badly that they need to fail. So.
All right, moving on. Well, we've been talking about climate change for a long time, and but, Job, you wanted to mention a different type of climate change, a conservative climate change?
Yeah, the interesting development this week, Barack Obama traveling to Mesa, Arizona, outside Phoenix for an event to push his stimulus plan. 500 conservative activists showed up to protest outside, and a scene that was very reminiscent of what happened in here and many other cities when George Bush came to visit.
Yes.
You have really a very interesting dynamic that's starting to unfold, and the seeds for this were planted during John McCain's presidential run, where you have on the conservative side so much rhetoric about Barack Obama being a socialist and being a menace, and you know all of the different narratives going on about he's a secret Muslim and yada yada.
Isn't helping his inability to talk about nationalization. Of course.
No, well it's not helping his ability to govern. Period.
I know.
But what's happening here is you've got a grassroots movement now because the conservative base has shrunk so much that the people who are left are very much sort of the hardcore. That despite all of the rhetoric of bipartisanship that's coming out of Obama and coming out of a lot of the media establishment, you're not seeing that from the conservative side. What you are seeing is a demonization of Obama that's very similar to what happened on the progressive side with George Bush for the last 8 years. So you're seeing a continuation of the kind of partisan climate that we've seen really since the era of Clinton, even though you're in a state of national emergency on several different fronts, on the economy, on climate change, on national security. But you've still got a significant portion of the American electorate that's invested in essentially the same sort of ideological games. We're also seeing that this week with the grandstanding that's going on with the six Republican governors trying to reject portions of the Obama stimulus package by claiming that that they don't want the money for their states because it would obligate them to, well, you know, spend it on the wrong people. So
we'll take it.
Yeah. So we're you know, despite the efforts at bipartisanship, you're likely to see a continuation of this very partisan sort of national political climate, and it's going to make trying to find, you know, real solutions for these problems much more difficult.
All right. And finally, on National This Week's Police Blotter.
Yes. You may have thought that Jack Abramoff went away. Well, he did go away. He's in a minimum security pen somewhere. But the scandal that bears his name is not. It continues to bear fruit and continues to remind us of just how corrupt not only the Republican infrastructure was during the Republican years of dominance of Congress, but that system, by and large, ethically still continues with the Democrats in power. This week it was Ann Copeland, who spent 29 years as an aide to Thad Cochran, a Republican senator from Mississippi, who sits on the very lucrative, from a corruption standpoint, Appropriations Committee in the Senate. She has pled guilty to essentially corruption charges in the Abramoff scandal. So another one bites the dust, and those investigations very quietly continue.
All right. That takes us then to international and Pakistan.
A lot going on with Pakistan and the United States this week. Pakistan signing a truce with the Taliban in the Swat area of Pakistan that's been controlled for the last year or so by insurgents. The United States disapproving of that. But at the same time, the United States, the Obama administration, walking a very thin line here. They're working very closely and much more closely these days with Pakistan, and expanded what is somehow mistakenly called a covert war, because everybody knows that the war is going on. Pilotless drones in Pakistan from the United States. We mentioned last week those are being flown from Pakistani air bases. What we saw this week after a visit to Pakistan by Richard Holbrooke, who's the Obama administration special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. He visited Islamabad a couple of days later. We saw two more pilotless drone attacks, one on Saturday, another one on Monday, targeting not the militants who have attacked U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, but the followers of a different militant, somebody named Massoud in Pakistan, who has primarily been in opposition to the internal Pakistani government. In fact, he is widely believed to have been responsible for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto a couple of years ago. So what we're seeing now is the United States expanding its war to target not only those militants who have targeted U.S. troops across the border in Afghanistan, but also militants who have not really engaged the United States directly at all, but who are targeting the Pakistani government. That is very much an expansion of the war, and it's happening with almost no public debate within the United States.
All right. That moves us on then to Afghanistan.
Yeah, the RAND Corporation released a report this week. The RAND Corporation, a very conservative group, but also very well respected. They tend to do a lot of research that goes into their reports, and their reports are recognized as very definitive by folks on the right as well as folks on the left. And they basically came out in their report called Afghanistan, the government that we support in Afghanistan, a narco state, and basically asked the question, what are we doing there since we're going to lose this war? We're facing a lot of the same issues that the Soviets faced when they were in Afghanistan, and there really is no way that U.S. troops can defeat the Taliban, particularly in the parts of the country where they're fighting right now. So I think that's very interesting that RAND released that report, and it happened to be the same week that President Obama has sent another or said that he's going to send another 17,000 troops to Afghanistan. And yet the Obama administration has not come up with any real plan to actually either disengage from Afghanistan, to deal with the corrupt Afghani government, or to win the war there.
All right. Finally, Israel.
Yeah, the fallout from the Israeli election continues this week. Benjamin Netanyahu was given the first opportunity to form a coalition government there, even though his party, the Likud party, the conservative, mainstream conservative party, actually narrowly finished second in the voting. But the reason they were given the first opportunity, at least the reason that is credited by most political observers, is that the third place finisher, a surprise finisher, was Avigdor Lieberman's party, the very conservative, not to say fascist party that is called essentially for the elimination of all Palestinians. So you have the possibility of a coalition government now that is not only not committed to a peace process in Israel, or not publicly committed, because I think you can make the argument that no government in Israel has actually been that interested in peace for many, many, many years now, but is actively and very publicly hostile to the idea of negotiations with Palestinians. This is something that the Obama administration is trying to prevent, but given that both the more mainstream parties, the Labor Party and the Kadima Party, have refused to join in a coalition government so far with the Likud, that may be the direction that it winds up going, and that is very, very troubling for the future of Israeli-Palestinian relationships.
All right. Still a couple seconds left to talk about things that go bump in the night.
Yes. British and French nuclear submarines smacked into each other this week in the waters, I believe it was off the French coast. It's very interesting that these two NATO allies have nuclear submarines and that they don't communicate with each other as to where the submarines are and when they are patrolling. And in fact, you know, you might ask the question, why? Just the basic question, why? Why do these countries still have nuclear submarines? Why do they not talk to each other about them? Are they expecting to send nuclear missiles in each other's direction anytime soon? And also ask, why are they allowing this hazard to continue? Because according to folks who took a look at the British submarine after the collision, it was a very near miss, and there could have been a lot of nuclear material in the ocean off the coast of France from this accident.
All right. And events this week.
Yeah, let's see. We have several coming up this week. On Wednesday at Town Hall, Tim Egan from the New York Times and my old boss, Newt Berger from the Seattle Weekly and Crosscut, talking about Berger's new book, Pugetopolis, and talking about development in the Puget Sound area and what that might look like in coming years and all of the problems therein. On Thursday night, also at Town Hall at 7:30, Aaron Glantz will be there pushing his new book. And, you know, you got details on that?
Yeah, 7:30. The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. So that'll be happening Thursday night at Town Hall. And Friday night, it's the sixth anniversary of Friday Night at the Meaningful Movies. They are presenting Consume This Movie with special guest Cecil Andrews coming to talk after the film, after or before, I'm not sure which.
Yeah, Cecil does a lot of work on simple living and reducing materialism and is very good. And we should just put a general plug in for Meaningful Movies. Every Friday night they have an awesome feature that's up at Keystone Church in Wallingford. So check that out anytime you get a chance on Friday night.
5019 Keystone Place North. And then finally, tomorrow, John West will be talking about his book, The Last Good Nights, Assisting My Parents with Their Suicides. It's tomorrow, 2 o'clock at Elliott Bay Books.
Yeah, he had a great interview at 7:30 for folks who are listening then.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, places where you pick up other free periodicals. And we can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.